Finish up on Methodism. Last time we talked about the Methodist Church. We talked about John Wesley being the founder. Talked about his background and his history. We talked about the Methodists having sprung from the Anglican Communion, that fellowship of Church of England Protestants, and they and John Wesley and his brother and other friends of theirs thought, we want to be more spiritual because we see the church lacking spirituality. So they started to get together and systematically studying and arranging different things in meetings and so on. So they had a method to their madness. They were so into the Bible, they called them Bible moths. They called them the holy clubbers. They called them the enthusiasts because they were enthusiastic about God's way of life. So they did all this studying. They did this studying, and because they became so different as a society within the church, that they had to basically leave the Church of England and start their own group, which became known as the Methodists. He took his version to America, to Georgia, and I'm going to read this to you before we, because it says here, John took his virgin, he came to him, he hoped he found a virgin, but anyway, he took his version to America. Now the scene, I'm still on yesterday's class on marriage. Okay. Now the scene shifts from the serenity of Oxford to America and a primitive settlement colonized by debtors and prisoners. General James Oglethorpe, organizer of the colony in Georgia, wanted a clergyman to minister to his settlers and possibly preach to the Indians. John volunteered and Charles became the general's secretary. The brothers sailed for the New World in 1735. On board the ship, John was particularly impressed by a band of Moravians from Germany who seemed unperturbed by the raging storms and demonstrated a faith far more secure and confident than his own. So he saw these people. We talked about that yesterday. These Moravians were the spiritual heirs of John Huss, the 15th century Bohemian reformer. And they say they go back 550 years. They go back even before the reformers. The Georgian experience was a fiasco. The Indians were not interested in the gospel, and Wesley called them gluttons, thieves, liars, and murderers. Real nice way to reach your audience. John fell in love with an 18-year-old girl in the colony, but she married another man. Perhaps in retaliation, he denied her Holy Communion. So he mixed his love affair with this situation. His harsh religious discipline antagonized his parishioners. In 1737, 2 years later, John Wesley sailed for England and judged his experience in America to be a failure. He said, "I who went to America to convert others was never myself converted to God." So what he found over there, the experience that he had, brought out some of the ugliness in his character, and therefore he was unable to reach the people. His own personal issues were getting in the way of serving the people. Again, a religious experience and a conversion took place in London. This was in 1738, a year later, and dramatically changed the direction of John Wesley's life. Before, he was very, very strict, methodical down the line. And for some weeks, he had been meeting with a band of Moravians, a group of them, in London. On May 24th, he dropped into a Moravian meeting and later described his experience. This is what I was trying to find yesterday. I think Chris was asking me about this. In the evening, he said, "I went very unwillingly to the society, to a society on Aldergate Street, where one was reading Luther's preface to the Epistle of the Romans. About a quarter before nine, while he was describing the change which God works in the heart through faith in Christ, I felt my heart strangely warmed. Felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ, Christ alone for my salvation, and an assurance was given to me that he had taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death." John Wesley was now 35 years old. He visited the Moravian settlement in Hernet, but returned to England. Wesley passed from a state of being God's slave to being his own son. So before, he was just kind of trying to do it to please God and appease God. Now he realized he'd been called to a higher calling. So he talked about his conversion there at that evening. He'd been baptized before, but he talked about his conversion. Now, you can also talk about what is conversion. Is conversion a one-time event? Did his heart suddenly feel warm? My heart sometimes feels warm when I've eaten too many hot things. My heart gets real hot, you know, and warm. Who knows what he had for dinner? Maybe he had too much chili pepper on his tacos or whatever he had for dinner that night. Who knows? But sometimes if you just go on feelings, and I have a sermon that it's been on the go since I was in Toronto, Canada in 1964. I've never given it. It's entitled, Do You Act on Feelings or Facts? And actually, you should act on both. But sometimes people let their feelings override the facts of the matter because they let their feelings become greater than the actual reality of what's going on. So he goes on to talk about what transpired there, and then he had a changed life at that time. So I'll go on and show you some more of the slides here. So anyway, he took his version to America, did not have much success because he expected too much of the Indians with whom he worked. He returned to England a failure. Moravians whom he met on a voyage gave him a sense of deeper conversion. Methodists spread rapidly in America because of the famed circuit riders. The circuit riders were awesome. I can read that in here to you. This is a brief summary from the Catholics, by the way. They used to put out little booklets like this about the different organizations. I'm going to read to you what he talked about the circuit riders. The man who did the most to plant Methodism firmly on American soil arrived in 1771. He was Francis Asbury, a blacksmith turned preacher. Now, these people put us to shame. Listen to what they did. Francis Asbury, he not only rode hundreds of thousands of miles himself and preached numerous sermons, but also organized the amazingly successful circuit riders who brought Methodism to the frontiers. Asbury arose every day at 4 a.m. He taught himself Latin, Greek, and Hebrew while in the saddle. And all the writing he was doing, he's practicing his Greek, his Hebrew, his Latin. When Asbury began his labors, he could count several thousand Methodists in the colonies. However, by the time he died in 1816, there were 200,000 who had taken out membership with the Methodists. Again, because they did not require a trained ministry, they were able to get out and move along. He talks about the circuit riders now. He says, circuit rider was the main reason why Methodism soon outstripped in numbers such denominations as the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, and the Congregationalists who had been in America a century or more before the first Methodist preacher ever arrived. So how did they outstrip them with these circuit riders? These denominations clung to the Atlantic seaboard and attempted to fill their pulpits with seminary-trained clergymen. Meanwhile, the Baptists and Methodists planted thousands of congregations in the Western settlement and in the South. The Methodist circuit rider was usually a single man who rode from one settlement to another. Many of these dedicated men burned themselves out before they were 30. They carried a Bible, a hymn book in their saddle bags and set up classes along the frontier, among the frontiersmen, according to the original Wesleyan pattern. So they rode hundreds of thousands of miles. I've got something on here. Let's see. Yeah, 158. Page 158 talks about the circuit riders. Grim statistics indicate that the lives of the men in the saddle were unusually hard. Of those who rode before 1800, half died before they were 30. Later, their longevity increased. Those who battled the trails up to 1844 had a better chance. Half of those lived to 33. Length of service was short. Two-thirds of the first 672 preachers whose records are available barely managed to remain on the trail 12 years.
How did Methodism return to America and get started with the
circuit? Well, after he left, then others came over after that time and began to plant it, even though he had gone back. I can bring you some of that information, too. A major reason for these early deaths was lack of adequate financial support. The allowance from 1784 to 1800, here's how much these people made, $64 a year. slightly less than $1.24 a week. These amounts, however, were merely projections. Only in unusual circumstances was anyone ever paid in full. But collecting a mere shred of their allowance was not the worst of the problem. Much of it was paid in kind. The records of an Indian circuit survive. And here's what they bought. Shoe leather and corn from a particular place, $1.75. Bridle leather from another place, 62 cents. One small pair of shoes, $1. One pair of shoe soles, 50 cents. 2.5 yards of linsey, $1.25. And in addition to the above, plus several other items, $16.77 in cash was raised. The treasurer wanted the amount to appear as large as possible, and indicated by some, as is indicated by 43¾ cents, which he placed on there. Prices, however, were reasonable. Tom Lincoln was building and selling coffins about this time, and a child's coffin brought $3, a woman's $6, a man's $7. In addition, hen's eggs could be bought for $5 a dozen. So the prices, but the acquiring riders was not easy. Talks about that. Circuit riders were encouraged to remain single and dress alike. Typical rider dressed in a charcoal black coat wore a flat crowned hat with a broad rim. At first he wore only knee breeches, but after 1800 he was allowed long trousers. Each parted his hair crosswise just behind the top of his head, his hair in the back brushed to his shoulders. Those on the circuit preached nearly every day. James Finley's circuit in Ohio included 25 stops. He touched 5 counties and took 4 weeks to circle. Except for Sundays, preaching was at noon. The reason for the midday service was there were few clocks in the backwoods, but everyone knew when the sun was overhead and it was time to go hear the preacher. Major theme of the riders was free grace, instant salvation, holy living, and seeking the Christian perfection, which was defined as sanctification or perfect love. By the way, sanctification is the one thing, and final perfection is the one thing that John Wesley and Methodism brought to Protestantism. A favorite expression was, "Between the saddle and the ground, his mercy sought and mercy found." And it goes on to say about their Methodist discipline, "We advise you," this is a directive, "we advise you as often as possible to rise at 4, from 4 to 5 in the morning, and from 5 to 6 to meditate, pray, read the scriptures with notes, closely follow the practical parts of what Mr. Wesley had published. From 6 in the morning until 12, allowing an hour for breakfast, read with much prayer some of the best religious tracts." Circuit riders and their welfare were Asbury's main concern, and he prayed for each person by name. Toward the middle of May in 1785, Asbury and Coke also helped found the area in America, found themselves near the home of George Washington. "Let's call on him and persuade him to sign a petition against slavery," as suggested Coke. So they actually went to see George Washington. Those were some of the things about, I see 181 and 185. Real quickly, just a couple of more quotes out of this book. This is by Francis Asbury, God's Circuit Rider. "Averaging 6,000 miles a year in a carriage or on horseback, pushing through storms and impossible trails, eating what was set before him, sleeping on crude beds, on the floor and on the ground for more than 40 years, had drained the little health that Asbury had enjoyed in his youth. Now in his 60s, his blonde hair was like snow, his back was bent, his voice was hoarse, his face was like an eroded hill. Having traveled with him during the last of his tour of the South, this one man remembered, quote, yet he would go on. There was only one thing that would stop him, the pale horse of death and his rider. Having lost the use of one of his feet by rheumatism, I had to carry him in my arms, place him in the sulky, take him out, carry him to the church or the private dwelling where he would sit and preach. At Fayetteville, North Carolina, I carried him into a church, and he preached. After the sermon, he ordained 3 persons. He had 1 blister on him, and I carried him to our host, who put on 3 more. I don't know what a blister. Anyway, at Wilmington, I carried him into the church, and he preached in the morning, and then met the society, and that was not enough. He must preach again in the evening. After this, he was in such misery, a poultice was applied to mitigate his pain. The next day, we rode 24 miles. So, just give you an idea of some of the things he did. Page 185. Soon Asbury's speech began to fail. Then lifting his hand, he was overwhelmed by a look of joy. He said, "Do you believe that Jesus is perfection, is precious?" asked Vaughn. Unable to answer, Asbury raised both hands. Shortly after this, while reclining in his chair, his head resting on Vaughn's hand, he passed away. The date was March 31st, 1816. He was in his 71st year. Burial was immediate, and since it was in a nearby burial ground, the expenses were minimal. Vaughn recorded them. They included $2 for digging the grave, $3 for wood to build the coffin, $20 for constructing a fence around the grave. Francis Asbury's early life had ended. It had not been wasted. At the first conference, only 10 preachers showed up, and in the entire membership in all the colonies was 1,160. That membership indicated that only one American in 3,000 was a Methodist. Now the 13 colonies had expanded to 18 states plus territories, and Methodist membership had grown to 214,000. This meant that nearly one out of every 40 Americans was now a Methodist. Better yet, there were nearly 700 active preachers and 14,000 classes. Indeed, Methodism had become the fastest growing religion in America. So, because of these famous circuit riders, I'll show you some examples of them as we go along. These itinerant preachers took Methodism to the logging camps and fur trading camps in the new territories. Became the largest Protestant church in America and was the largest until 1920. So at that time, then the Baptists now are the largest. There you see the circuit rider, as described. Tremendous growth for 50 years because of the circuit riders. They took religion to the people. Now, here's what you have to say. If we wanted to go out and get people and drag them in, if we could just go out and drag them to church, come on to church, come on, we're having donuts today. Come on, we're having rock and roll band and we're giving away donuts and coffee. You get a lot of people coming in. Don't require anything of them. Don't ask them to live God's way of life. Give them some feel nice sermon or sermonette and give them lots of music so they can sit there and cash back and have no requirement for how they dress. Let them come as you are, come as you please, come as you may, and be as you may. Just come and be with us. You get lots of people. And people out there that prove it. Religions are out there that prove it. You see, the circuit rider, two-thirds of the first 672 riders were only able to continue for 12 years. You see them having to go through storms and all the rest to get to their area. And I can tell you, as a minister out in the field, and I'm nowhere near the privation, I have a nice car, heater, air conditioner, and all the rest, that there is a pressure that you've got to be there every week. You've got to be there at church every week, especially if you're the only minister in the area. And sometimes I've given two sermons on holy days because I was the only minister there to do it. In other cases, and sometimes you lead songs. Sometimes I've even played the piano. I can only play with one hand because I play the accordion. Sometimes you even play the piano, and you can't lead songs and play the piano. Sometimes I play the piano for someone else, and then go up and give the sermon. Other cases, and I didn't play that often. Mr. Kubik does play the piano, by the way. He did play for one of the hymn services or song services. That's kind of nice. The minister plays the piano for it, and he gets up and speaks. Sometimes you do it all, and you've got people waiting there for you, and you know you dare not get sick. You know you dare not miss because those people are waiting. So I can picture those people having to go through no matter what. Here's a picture of Francis Asbury, famous circuit rider. Here's a plaque in his honor. It said the pioneer bishop of American Methodism, and the foremost among her tireless itinerants. Born in England, August 30th, 1745, entered the ministry at the age of 17, preached his first sermon in this church, November 13th, 1771, was ordained bishop, December 24th, 1984, died near Fredericksburg, Virginia, March 31st, 1816. He ordained over 3,000 preachers and preached over 17,000 sermons. Dying, he left the whole church the legacy of his labors, patience, perseverance, and love to God and man. So that's the tribute to Francis Asbury. Peter Cartwright was also one of the writers, and they would say, "Have you a horse, a Bible, can you preach, and are you converted?" And if they said yes, 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 they got to go out and preach. Organization, they have a general conference that meets, it's the highest level of the body of the church, and it meets every 4 years. Council of Bishops is elected by the clergy and the laity and forms the executive branch. And what we don't realize is, in many churches, like Methodism and others, you have people who come out to the church, preachers come out and audition. Okay, I'm going to give you my best sermon. And so you give your best sermon and you hope that they select you instead of someone else. The laity many times selects who the minister is. And our current instruction says the laity should have input. You know, about, you know, when they're losing a minister and getting another one, if they have anything to say, they should bring it to the attention of the administration about the person they're to receive. Democratic in their general approach and are extremely detailed in their committees. Here's a, just to give you an idea about committees, here's from the First United Church in California. Groups, activities, and opportunities. And I'm only going to read you a few, just to give you an idea. Okay. Children, for children, this is children. Children, they have church school, church choirs, church Easter, children's Easter camp, elementary children outlines, they have Epworth School, carpenter's children, church school, confirmation class, United Methodist Youth Fellowship, youth choir, winter and summer youth camps, and Boy Scout Troop 27. Here's what they have for the adults. They have pastor's forum, adult Bible study, parents class, discovering First Church, singles. For the singles, they have a young adult Bible study, prime time, that's for the older, 35 to 55, serendipities, the 50 to 70s, special fun events for all ages, retreats, service events. For monthly fellowship meetings, they have the pathfinders, the questers, the lamplighters, the Aldersgate, inspiration, fellowship, service for the entire family. They have choirs. They have children's choir, kindergarten choir, primary choir, junior choir, youth handbell choir, second youth handbell choir, children's handbell choir, the chancel choir, and special music. For the women, they have Methodist Hospital Women's Auxiliary, Women's Activities Council, United Methodist Women. They have Fellowship Group 1, Fellowship Group 3, Fidelis Group, Hilltoppers, Mabel Snudden Group, Servitors, and Christian Women's Forum. Other groups, it's not enough, First Quarter, Blood Bank, Camping, Cassette Tape Ministry, Chapel, Church Paper, Counseling, Drama, Family Camps, Fellowship Hour, Get Acquainted Breakfast, Greeters, Hospital Visitation, Library, Liturgical Dance, they have a Shalom group. And I'm not even finished yet. Jason?
I'm wondering, is that out of a really big organization, or is that like one church's programs?
I don't know how big the United Church. One church. It's one church. One church. Yeah. This comes from the First United Church, 500 East Colorado Boulevard, Pasadena, California. All the things they do. And I didn't even get to the last two pages.
Okay.
I just give you an idea of what they're like. There's another booklet. This is similar to scriptographic books that gives you a whole history of about the church and how they came into existence. It talks about John Wesley, talks about beginnings of the church, talks about foundations of the church, talks about their church leaders, Thomas Koch and others, talks about the divisions of the church, and unification, how their church is, and so on, how they get along and what they do. So, talks about John Wesley's childhood and conversion. So they have these little booklets. We could actually have this done for United if we wanted to. Could actually send to them our basic core beliefs, and they put it together, and you approve it, and then they put it together. So it's a quick synopsis of it. Dana? I'm sorry? I don't know. I've never done a liturgical dance, but I would imagine it's a dance that indicates, it's kind of a dance that brings a message.
You can ask my dad. That's what we were before we came to the church of God. I don't remember a whole lot about it, but my dad was studying to be a minister, and he was pretty high up in the church, and we were Methodists. So,
he would know. Maybe he'd come in. Can you ask him if he'd come in and do a liturgical dance for us?
Oh, I guess what it is.
Okay. Okay, laymen have prominent positions in the church. Steph?
Not that I would necessarily about this, but a lot of that is very similar to my background. And the liturgical dance is basically dance more along the lines of just having to do like Christian music. Now, I mean, in a Methodist setting, was probably way more conservative than some stuff that I possibly saw, but that's basically what it is.
So you saw liturgical dance. Okay. So now we know. anybody needs to know liturgical dances, see Stephanie. She can give us an illustration. All right, they're democratic. Their Apostles' Creed is recited every Sunday. Salvation is by grace of God and involves living life according to the gospel. Heaven and hell are not only literal places, but some believe they're merely states of mind. You're in heaven if you're feeling good. You're in hell if you don't feel good. Some of their beliefs, traditional Protestant theology with slight variations. Now, I haven't read to you, nor have I given to you, I don't think, unless it's in the back of the handout that I gave you originally. There's a section on classical Protestant theology. I would like to share just the short version. You could look up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and you'll find 16 points. And these are common principles, ideas, practices of the magisterial reformers and their successors. So this is what they said made up Protestants. But I'm going to give you the short version. There are only six in the Encyclopedia Americana. And here's what they are. This is classical Protestant theology. This is what most Protestants believe. Number one, justification by grace through faith. Do we agree with that? Yes? You are justified by grace through faith. And what do we mean by faith? We may argue over that with them. But number one is correct. Number two, they believe in faith and works. Faith and works. Number three, predestination. God chooses who will or will not be brought to salvation. And if you want to say it has to do with calling, we could also agree with that one. Okay, who's called now or not, but not. We believe that all people will have a chance. And number three is predestination. Number four is classical Protestant theology is you believe in the prime authority of the Holy Bible. The prime authority of the Holy Bible. Number five, most classical Protestants believe in the priesthood of all believers. Why do they believe that? Because that gives them the right to study the Bible when Catholics were saying only the priests could. Number five, priesthood of all believers. And number six, two sacraments, baptism and communion, or Lord's Supper. So those are that gives you a summation of the other 16 points, which talks about emphasis on preaching, liturgies and hymns, confessions or creeds, Protestant confessions or creeds, concern for further reformation, some of the other ones they add to it, de-emphasis on basis of authority, they don't want the authority of the Pope, man is simultaneously righteous and sinful, and let's see, the influence of Paul's writings heavily influenced this Protestant theology. So those six areas gives you an idea. So they have that they have Protestant theology with slight variations, and they are similar to Anglicans. Two rites, they believe in baptism and the Lord's Supper. Sprinkling is commonly used for the spiritual experience of baptism. So sprinkling is commonly used, called a ceremony for induction into the kingdom. So they believe you're actually going to be put into the kingdom by that means. Lord's Supper is observed as a memorial with bread and grape juice as symbols. And we'll see why in a moment. Because they were very much, Methodists became very active in social affairs and trying to change social conditions in the country. And as a result, they did not like drink. So they actually managed to lobby sufficiently to get the 18th Amendment, I think it was the 18th Amendment, on prohibition. And when my dad and mom were growing up, my mom remembers my aunt, her older sister, actually dating a bootlegger, a guy who was actually making booze on the side. And the police were chasing them. My mom remembers being in the back of this car and the police chasing her and bullets whizzing by and hitting into the car as this man was driving away, you know, from them. And he had a pretty hot car, so I guess he was able to outdrive the police, who didn't have hot cars back then. Their bicycles didn't quite catch up. But it wasn't bicycles, but they were able to elude it and drive somewhere and stop. She remembers that as a young teen. And my dad remembers at his wedding, he said it was the cheapest wedding ever. that they did. All they did, they got married, and then he was able to, more people came to their wedding than they had anticipated, so they thought, what are we going to do now after they were married at this church? What do we do now? Well, they said, there's a hall down there, so they were able to get this hall for like $5 or whatever for the whole evening. And he managed to go get some bootleg booze, mixed it with Coca-Cola or whatever they had, and they had a jukebox there, so they were able to put some coins in there, a nickel, five songs or whatever, and people danced. Bootleg booze with some soda pop, and that was their, and I don't even know if they even had a cake. So that was it. But they remember the bootlegging was done. But they were a group that triggered that. They believe in separation of church and state, very strongly believe in that, as do the Baptists. They've opposed the use of liquor to the point of supporting prohibition. Carrie Nation is a lady here from times past, and her WCTU. WCTU means Women's Christians Temperance Union. I prefer to call them WCPU, okay? Not because they stink, but because WC Prohibition, Women's Christian Prohibition Union. It wasn't temperance that they believed in. They believed in prohibition. She took the axe to many bars.
I've been to the Eaton Hotel with Scholar. She actually took the axe to the bar.
You what now? You saw?
I've been to the bar.
Where she actually took it.
Yeah.
Where was it?
Wichita is the Eaton Hotel.
Okay, Eaton Hotel. So we'll take a look at it, and you'll see a few pictures of her in a moment. They've been socially active for many community causes and are quite ecumenical. They want to try to bring about togetherness, very much so. Universal redemption, they say Christ died for all. There you see Carrie Nation, and there you see a Carrie Nation in the WCTU. You'll notice her little her axe, or let's say a symbolic axe has her name on it, Carrie Nation. There's the axe. I'll show you a few other pictures. There she is again with her hatchet. Carrie Nation and her hatchet for destroying saloons. What these women would do, they would gather together. Of course, saloons were just for men. They would gather together in front of the saloons where their men had gone into, or sons or brothers or whatever. They would gather together there and they would pray in front of it. And after they would pray in front of it, they would go in and try to destroy the bar, you know, the serving area of it, and smash bottles or whatever else. So there it is. There she is carrying her Bible in her one hand, or her hatchet in the other. Here you see them, the ladies here praying. Look at the guys standing here. And there's, it says saloon. It's an actual picture. The women are kneeling with their long dresses on, with all their petticoats underneath. They're all kneeling here praying and getting ready to go attack. Jacob?
Did the men try to stop the women?
If they could, but I mean, again, you're not supposed to. Back in those days, there was a respect for women. You didn't exactly touch them or wrestle with them. So I guess they just pushed on through. They had enough gumption. They just pushed on through. Here's that gives you a sense of it. Now, that Methodists have three major beliefs. One, final perfection. Three major beliefs that they brought. Number one is final perfection. What Methodism gave to the Protestant is that you could achieve perfection to a degree in this life. You could achieve perfection to a degree in this life. So there was a working on themselves. And of course, that would be natural, because what was the way John Wesley was? Trying to be a holy clubber, trying to be a Bible enthusiast, trying to be a Bible moth, and trying to study and get together, and let's do this and let's do that, and let's have this meeting and let's have that meeting to improve ourselves spiritually. Second one is regeneration, a new birth, the process by which one receives God's Holy Spirit. Regeneration is another term, the terminology used, a new birth, that you are a new person. And thirdly, witness of the Spirit, that a person can know that they are a child of God. Now, John Wesley in Methodism didn't take it beyond, but when we study Pentecostals at the end of the year, you'll see that the Pentecostals said, yes, you should be able to know you are a child of God, and you should give evidence of that. And that's where speaking in tongues comes in, or falling over and having some type of a vision. That's where that comes in, that's a sign that you have God's Holy Spirit. Without that, you can't prove that you do. So that's what they believe. So he stopped with three, but some said he really believed you should be able to give witness that you are. A person can know that they are a child of God. Additional information, Methodism has a wide appeal to various ethnic groups, wide latitude of beliefs from congregation to congregation. In order to teach theology in an accredited institution, you have to have at least a master's degree and 18 upper division units in theology. Now, I had a master's degree in counseling or marriage and family therapy. Well, that didn't entitle me to teach theology. So I had to go, we had to take theology. None of our faculty was credentialed to teach theology. Now, did we need credentialing for men? No. But if you're going to be accredited, you did. So the way we solved this was Dr. Ward, when he comes in, he arranged with Southern Methodist University to send some of their professors over to Ambassador College, and we every Sunday we got together all day long, 8 hours a day, sat there, and this instructor brought us various courses, so we took 18 upper division units in theology. It was our choice of which classes we took. But I very much remember the first occasion. I had just finished my master's degree. I was grateful at age 50, I had finished my master's degree and came back and they said, guess what, you get to sit in more classes. Oh, thanks a lot. That's the last thing I wanted to do. And you had to do a lot of book reading, a lot of reading of books in between. So teach you the class 8 hours and then give you books to read. So you had books to peruse and read and papers to write weekly. The fellow who came the first time was Methodist. So me being a comparative religion buff, I said, now, what type of Methodist are you? Are you Wesleyan Methodist? Are you, liberal Methodist? Are you conservative? He said, well, let me tell you what the type we are. He said, if you ask six Methodists the same question, you'll get seven different answers. Okay, now I understand. So they were not unified. So the wide latitude of beliefs from one to one. Liberalism has become widely accepted by Methodists, and they have lost membership over the last decades, and I could show you that decline as well. They've lost millions of people, and particularly in Canada, when I first moved up there in 65, we had hundreds of people writing in for visits, where they were tired of a religion that didn't stand for anything, that didn't do anything, that was just kind of milquetoast, blah religion, that was considered the Bible, portions of the Bible, a fable, and did not really stand for much. They were looking for someone that stood for something. John?
Why does it apply so much to
the ethnic groups? Why? I think because they originally went out and because of their wide latitude of allowance, their tolerance, their liberality applies to them. In fact, I can show you that. More American Indians follow this faith than any other, and one of two Japanese American Christians is a Methodist. So the Japanese and the Indians would fall into the Methodist camp. And that gives you the prominent locations, and next time we'll do the What Am I's. I'll show you this. They've lost 2 million since 1970. In 30 years, they've lost 2 million people. And again, as the U.S. population has gone up, their population has gone down. All right, thanks for bearing with me, and we'll see you tomorrow.